I'm Chris Busby. I'm an expert on the health effects of low-level radiation, particularly internal low-level radiation, which I've studied for many years, since about 1990. And I've written several books and published over 50 papers in peer-reviewed literature and various places about the health effects of internal radiation. And I've been asked recently to address the issue of the tritium being released from the Fukushima plant storage area into the Pacific, which is upsetting an awful lot of people, mainly in China and Korea and Japan also.
Okay, can you just explain why the word tritium is involved and how it's come that this water cannot be treated or whatever before it's being released?
Yes, of course. Well, tritium is a form, a radioactive form of hydrogen, and the form in which it always appears in nuclear power station and nuclear bombs and so forth is as a sort of water in which the tritium, which is a radioactive form of hydrogen, it's hydrogen 3. Normally you've got hydrogen is has the atomic number 1. This has got atomic number 3, and it's radioactive. It, in the environment, it has a half-life, well, no, in physically it has a half-life of approximately 12 years, so it hangs about. And it's produced in all nuclear reactions as a consequence of neutrons adding to ordinary water. And of course, nuclear power stations operate on the basis of cooling water, and the cooling water in most of the reactors is just ordinary water, but in some reactors, the Canadian ones in particular, which are also used in other parts of the world, particularly Korea, where they use heavy water, they use deuterium, that's hydrogen 2. But tritium is hydrogen 3, and hydrogen 3 is radioactive. It decays to an element, an isotope called helium 3, and gives off a very weak beta ray at the same time. So the energy of the beta decay is not very great. And on the basis of this, the nuclear industry and their scientists, who have a particular way of dealing with radiation, they measure it in terms of energy per unit mass absorbed. Because the energy from the tritium is very, very weak, and the range of the electron, the beta electron from the tritium is very short range, they more or less classify it as harmless. One of the reasons they classify it as harmless is because actually it's the largest release of any radionuclide from nuclear processes by far. So the legal limits for exposure to tritium are absolutely almost not there. And people and the nuclear industry scientists say, well, you can more or less drink tritiated water and it will have no effect on you. Anyway, the other thing about tritium is you can't really easily remove it from water because it's very tritiated water is really very similar to ordinary water. I mean, you can take it out, but it's extremely expensive to do so. And given the vast amounts of it,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm reminded of this whole business at the early days of nuclear power and nuclear weapons, where there was the need to extract uranium-235 from uranium, and they also said at the time this is going to be extremely awkward, extremely difficult, but they did it. So why can they not do a similar thing with tritium?
Well, they can. I mean, in fact, a lot more easily. You know, to separate 235 from 238 is very hard because they're very, very similar in terms of mass, but to separate from 3 from 1 is actually not that hard to do. Although, of course, it does cost a lot of money, and they've got 1.3 million tons of radioactively contaminated water, so they would have to set up a special plant to do this. And they could do it, but it would cost them a lot of money, and they're not prepared to put that sort of money into it. They'd much prefer to just dip it into the sea.
Would you like to hazard a guess at how much something like that would cost?
I couldn't really imagine. I mean, it would certainly cost billions. I mean, put it like that. Absolutely. They would have to have a... some sort of osmosis plant or centrifugation plant or something like that. And then at the end of it, of course, they still have a load of tritium, but then at least they could then reduce the amount that they've got and sort of stick it in a box for many years so that it didn't cause any harm. But they truly believe it's safe. That's the problem. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, who seem to be the lead in arguing this point about the safety of tritium, have said all sorts of things about how safe it is because the doses from the tritium are smaller than... I mean, there was one guy that I had to laugh, really. There's this outfit called the Science Media Center that was set up by a woman called Fiona Fox. And their operation is to have a load of tame scientists who head off any arguments about problems relating to health or basically anything.
They were very active during the COVID.
Yes, I'm sure they were. But anyway, I went to look and see what they had to say about, and of course, they're all over the internet saying this, what they had to say about this tritium thing. And there was one guy there that they had from the University of somewhere or another in Perth, Western Australia, who said that to drink all of, if somebody were to drink all of the releases of the Pacific Ocean in terms of, you know, all the shellfish and fish and seafood and everything, from the releases to the ocean, it would be less of a dose than eating one quarter or one half of a banana. I mean, so it's this sort of cartoon science that we're up against, and these people are just liars. They're just dishonest, and they're paid to say these things. But the reality is that tritium is very, very dangerous. I did a study in 2003 in the Plymouth Dockyard. This is when I first came across all of this. There was a guy called Ian Avent who was complaining about what he'd heard. There were high levels of leukemia near the dockyard. So we said, well, all right, okay, we'll go and look and knock on doors and do the sort of questionnaire study that we did in Burnham-on-Sea and what we did in Trawsfynydd near the nuclear power station and Burnham-on-Sea near Hinkley Point. And we can find out what's going on. And he did that. And we had about 700 in Torpoint and on the other side, Keyham. And we found about a 17 to 30%, not 30%, 30-fold increase in leukemia in the wards close to the contaminated mud of the Tamar, contaminated because the Devonport Dockyard submarines just pumped the stuff out into the river. And so it gets into the mud and it gets into the shellfish and all the little worms and invertebrates and so forth down there. And of course, it gets into the people as well. And the people then get leukemia and then they die. And that's what we found. And we went down there and we had a meeting down there, a public meeting down there. And I met a man there who worked at the University of Plymouth, professor there now. At that time, he was just a research chap called Awadesh Jha. And he was also interested in the effects of tritium from the dockyard releases. And he'd done studies of tritium on mussels and various invertebrates that lived in the mud and found that very, very low doses, tiny, tiny doses, conventionally assessed, that's by the system of the International Commission on Radiological Protection, this business about energy per unit mass, he found that tiny, tiny doses caused massive developmental defects and chromosome damage and so forth. So we know that the tritium causes these effects in invertebrates. And from my own epidemiology there, we found these high levels of leukemia in people living near the dockyard. And more recently since then, I have looked at the health effects of sailors, the health effects in sailors, American sailors, who serve on nuclear ships. And we found there's a tenfold excess in cancer on sailors who operate nuclear ships. And I've just recently done a big court case in the Scottish courts for a man called John Forbes, who died of lymphoma. Of course, we lost the case because the British government will not allow anybody to win one of these radiation cases. But in that affair, we managed to get some data under the Freedom Information Act that showed that these sailors on the British nuclear submarines were contaminated with material from nuclear reactor. So it's more or less all tied up and sealed and delivered. It's just that the governments of the world will not permit anyone to believe this stuff and will continue to pump out all of this nonsense about bananas.
Yeah, well, can you just clarify where this tritium is coming from? Is it just discharging of cooling water from reactors in these submarines in Devonport, for example?
Yeah, pretty much. And in fact, I mean, I did a Freedom of Information request on releases from... nuclear submarines in Holy Loch in Scotland in the last few months. I'm following this up now. I'm quite interested. I've sort of got my nose into it. And I got a response from them to say that the releases that that they had given permission for the submarines in the Holy Loch to release 1 megabecquerel a year of tritium. I mean, that's 1 million becquerels of tritiated water they're allowed to release. And also carbon 14. No, two megabecquerels of tritium and 1 megabecquerel of carbon 14. And this stuff comes about as a result of neutrons in the reactor. Now, reactors operate on neutrons. That's how they work. So neutrons in reactors are what fly about, split atoms, and cause heat to occur. And the heat is carried away by water, pressurized water reactors. But of course, the water itself, when the neutrons hit the water, they turn the hydrogen atoms into tritium. So the water is contaminated with tritium oxide. And of course, eventually they've got to get rid of this stuff. So they pump it through various ion exchange resins in order to try and get rid of it. But tritium is virtually impossible to get rid of because it's very close, tritiated water, very, very close to ordinary water. And again, you know, like I said before, it's extremely costly to separate the tritiated water from the ordinary water. So that's the origin. The origin is in the nuclear reactors, in the neutrons.
To me, like the heart of this story is really a failure to properly regulate the dangers of this nuclear waste. So, I mean, you've told us how they do it and that they do it wrong. How should they, if they were to start from scratch, start from square one again, what would be a sensible way to actually start measuring genuinely the health effects of these materials?
Well, they would have to do some epidemiology, but actually the epidemiology has already been done. I mean, what they could do is they could do what I did in America. They could look at they could do honest, independent epidemiology of sailors operating on nuclear submarines and nuclear-powered ships. They could do that. And that would tell them that something was very badly wrong. And then what they would have to do is they'd have to look inside the people. They would have to do an epidemiological study of the people themselves and compare them to people who didn't work on nuclear power ships and see what was inside them, see how much tritium was inside them, how much carbon-14 was inside them. They could do that. And actually, I have to say they probably already have. Almost certainly they already have. But they're just covering it up because, of course, if they find out that there's a big increase in cancer and that it's associated with exposure to carbon-14 and to tritium, then they will have to stop operating nuclear-powered ships. Right. I mean, and nobody's going to want to do that. Or at very minimum, they're going to have to put much more shielding around the reactors, which will make the thing much heavier. And they're going to have to deal with all the releases on the basis that these substances are much more dangerous than they thought. So in my operation...
I think that they don't necessarily think that. It seems to me like they've come up with a system of regulation and assessing danger of particular materials based on what they want. So I'm still not clear about how they've managed to wing that. They're saying that these various discharges of different radioactive elements are causing that you can detect them, but they're somehow managing to spin it so that they're almost ignoring the health effects. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that is what I'm saying. And the reason and the way in which they've done this in the past, although it's becoming increasingly difficult for them to do it, is to base their assessment of the cancer consequences of exposure to radiation on the Japanese A-bomb studies, on the Hiroshima and Nagasaki studies, the lifespan studies of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the whole of the risk model that they have is based on this concept of dose, and the doses are nothing to do with what elements they are. I mean, as far as they're concerned, each element only contributes energy. So they don't care whether it's tritium and it's like water, or carbon and it's like your body, or you know, sodium or whatever it is. They don't really care except with regard to where it's likely to end up in your body. They deal them all in the same way, and they say how much energy is released into an organ by the material that you have inside you. And so that excludes any sort of chemistry, any sort of chemical affinity for DNA, any sort of behavior. There's no chemistry at all. This is all physics. And these physicists have set up this bogus system long ago, and it was underpinned by the World Health Organization and the International Atomic Energy Agency and the International Commission on Radiological Protection and all sorts of high-sounding sort of organizations of the United Nations. And this study, this model is still in place. So this model says that the amount of energy released from tritium is so small, it can't possibly cause any harm. And if you say, well, excuse me, but here's a place where there's lots of tritium and everybody's got leukemia, they say, well, it can't possibly be the tritium because the energy is too small. It's a sort of ridiculous, circular, dishonest argument, rather like Azande witch doctors, you know, like it can't be this, so it must be that, and if it can't be that, it must be this. It goes round and round in circles.
So is there any difference really between the position of the British government on this and the Nuclear Regulation Agency and the industry itself?
They're the same person.
Well, surely the government is regulating the industry, Chris.
No, the government put itself at the government used to have the Medical Research Council, and they used to actually try and look at this stuff sensibly. And then they put it at arm's length when it began to look that there was some problem round about the time of the nuclear fallout in the 60s. And they handed the job over to an outfit called the National Radiological Protection Board, which was an agency. And these people were physicists and they were computer modelers. And so they wrote down that this can't be so. So the first thing that happened that raised attention to the possibility that internal radiation was killing people was the Sellafield leukemia cluster. Suddenly the TV people, Yorkshire Television, they discovered that there was this huge tenfold excess of childhood leukemia near Sellafield. So then National Radiological Protection Board, who are the people appointed by the government, an agency, an arm's length, they came along and said, well, it can't possibly be the radiation because the dose is too low. The energy is too small. And then people said, well, we don't believe you. So they had a big inquiry under Sir Douglas Black, and they had a court case in 1992 where two of these children who had leukemia took Sellafield to court, took British Nuclear Fuels to court, and they lost. And they lost because the main man who was saying that it was a problem suddenly died unexpectedly of cancer. Rather suspiciously, I have to say. And so, and what you don't realize is that these people are just like the people who are operating the world at the moment. Okay, they're the same people. So all they need to do if they want to prove something is they set up some bogus organization called the International Commission for telling you what's right and what's wrong. And they put a load of people on it, hand them a load of money, and they come out and they say, well, I'm sorry, I'm afraid all you people who think that radiation is killing children are wrong because you're not scientists and you're just idiots and you don't understand numbers and so forth. I mean, I came into this game in 1992 when I decided to take on these scientists. Unfortunately, the Green Movement don't really have any scientists, and they didn't have then. They're very nice people, and they're philosophers, and they're very clever people, and historians and social justice people and so forth. But by and large, they're not much good when it comes to numbers. And so that's the job that I took on. I set up Green Audit, and Green Audit's job is to look at all of these things and try and find out what's really going on. And in this case, I eventually looked at Fukushima and the tritium. I have to say one thing about Fukushima and tritium is that the total amount being released by the Japanese into the Pacific is very low compared to the amount that was released by Sellafield into the Irish Sea and the amount that was released by the nuclear reactors all along the Hinkley Point up through Bradwell. I don't mean Bradwell, I mean Barclay and all those up the Severn Estuary. The amount of tritium on the Severn Estuary and down towards Hinkley Point is really pretty much. And you can if you look at the government reports, you can find tritium inside blackberries, inside fish, inside more or less everything. And a study that I did of Hinkley Point in 2000 for Stop Hinkley, using British government data on deaths from cancer, showed that there was a highly a significant seacoast effect on breast cancer and lung cancer, and also on infant mortality, people living near the tritium contaminated coasts of the Severn Estuary, and the same on the other side as well, on the Welsh side. So it's not as if they don't know all of this.
So is it feasible for people on the Japanese coast and maybe the Chinese and other people concerned about this to actually sit there with a Geiger counter and pick this stuff up? Or is it so diluted that it would probably...
No, it's not that. It's not that it's diluted. It's that, like I said, the energy is so low that you can't pick it up with a Geiger counter. you have to have a special thing called a liquid scintillation counter to measure this stuff. And the same at carbon 14. Both of those things have weak beta emitters. They're not gamma emitters, so you can't detect this stuff at all. It's absolutely invisible unless you have some highly sophisticated and expensive equipment. Of course, the Chinese government can do it. That the Korean government can do it, and people in Japan could theoretically do it if they had a bit of money to pay for the equipment. But basically, we know that the stuff is there. We don't need them to measure it. We know it's there, and they admit that it's there. And they say, oh, the concentration will be X and Y and Z and so forth. What has to be done is people have to realize that those little low concentrations of X and Y and Z are absolutely lethal, and they kill you. It's a risk model. It's a risk model that's the problem. The risk model is key to all of this. The risk model has to be overturned.
Are they right to be worried about this? Are you saying that actually that you think maybe that the Sellafield discharges were more dangerous?
Yes, the Sellafield discharges were more dangerous. And the study I did for the Irish government, I looked at cancer in Wales, in the small areas of Wales, between 1974 and 1990. And this was paid for by the Irish state in relation to a court case that was being taken against Sellafield by four people in Dundalk in the Irish Republic. And that was a huge study. It took me 3 years to do that. I had to get a lot of students to help me, and we had to get all the data out and figure it all out and do all the studies and everything. And I more or less wrote up the results in my book, Wolves of Water, which I published in 2006, which the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust paid me to do. And that book's around. So that tells you what we found is that there was this massive increase in cancer in a coastal strip of about 1 to 2 kilometers, and mostly in North Wales, where all this stuff ends up, and where it's all measured, where you can find it in all of the Rife data, in the radioactive in food and environment data published by the environmental protection people. So it's all there. It's about a 30% increase in cancer by the end of the period, by about 1990. And that was the period where Sellafield was pumping stuff out like there was no tomorrow. I mean, they've cut down a lot now. But in those days, around about 1985, 86 or something, they were just pouring everything into the Irish Sea. And of course, and Captain La Hague is worse. I mean, the French outfit, blimey! I mean, the amount pushed out by the French outfit is about 20 times the amount. No, hang on, 400 times the amount pushed out by Fukushima into the Pacific. So let's see. Well, yeah, that's right. That's right. So huge amounts of tritium pumped out by the French reprocessing facility at Cap de la Hague near Alderney. And that's another thing I did. I did a study of Alderney. And so some people from Alderney asked me to go over there and check it all out. And I went over there and I found everyone was dying of leukemia in Alderney as well. Alderney is just across the sea, about like 10 kilometers across the sea from the Cap de la Hague plant where they pump it all out, and it all ends up on the beach. So I've got a lot of videos of me, and they made a program about it. It's on, the Germans made a documentary about Cap de la Hague and all that stuff being pumped out, and there's pictures of me wandering along the beach with a scintillation counter measuring radioactivity.
I mean, it might not be your area, but we have seen, haven't we, an explosion in cancer, even, you know, childhood cancers, people at midlife suddenly being struck by this illness. I mean, is it really, there may be other reasons, but is this likely, do you think, to have been the sort of post-war discharges of radiation or not?
Yes, it certainly was the fallout. The biggest injection of radioactivity into the atmosphere was the weapons testing fallout from 1959 to 1963. So anyone born in that period, and the children of the people born in that period, have all got a higher rate of cancer. I mean, I've done the study. I've looked at levels of cancer in areas of high rainfall and compared them with areas of low rainfall, high fallout, low fallout, high strontium, low strontium, and they all show that the cancer epidemic that we're seeing and which is increasing was basically fundamentally underpinned by the weapons fallout, and the stuff got into the milk, it got into the food, it got into the air, it got everywhere. So there's that. And of course, you know, that's also added to by the releases from places like Sellafield and La Hague and, you know, Irish Sea and so on. But it's mostly radiation. Radiation is the most dangerous mutagen of all mutagens. There's no argument about it. If you want to look to see why somebody's got cancer, the probability is they got cancer because of the fallout, and or because they live near the Irish Sea or the Bristol Channel or Hinkley Point or whatever.
The Chinese have recently announced that they're going to be building a whole load of these tritium, small modular tritium reactors, and they're going to be going all over China. Now, they argue that actually they will be treating the tritium, they won't be releasing it, and that this is, although it won't be producing plutonium, is actually a viable form of nuclear energy.
Well, I don't know. I have to wait and see. But I can tell you that the small modular reactor sort of hysteria is based on reactors that are similar to the ones that are used on ships. The reason that they're small is because they've got very thin shielding. And so the neutrons get out of the shielding and they interact with nitrogen in the air and turn it into carbon dioxide, carbon-14 dioxide. And then, of course, like I said, all of the water is contaminated with tritium. And I mean, it's great if they're going to make one where they can take out all the tritium and the carbon-14. You know, why not? But they're still going to be left with all of the nuclear waste, and then they've got to put that somewhere. I don't really think that, but I mean, I'm not anti-nuclear on that level. I think I'm anti-nuclear on the level that we need to address the truth. You know, so people shouldn't be told that these things are marvelous and they're wonderful and they're going to solve the problems of global warming and we can have business as usual and make just as many things, you know, but then run it all on nuclear power rather than running it on coal and producing carbon footprints and whatnot. They need to know the truth. And the truth is that nuclear power kills. That's it. And so if your auntie died of cancer, it's like 25% probable that she died of cancer because of radiation from nuclear power stations and from nuclear weapons testing.
Well, instead, we're being told that Londoners are dying from particulates and therefore we've got to have a charge on cars in London. So I wonder what you make as a scientist of this whole idea about, you know, cleaning up air, stopping diesel vehicles, charging people to drive down the street, charging people to drive across the country is what they effectively want to do eventually, which is road pricing.
Tony, I'm an old greenie, you know. I mean, I'm not a new greenie. I mean, the new Green Party I don't have a lot of time for, but the old Green Party I do. And I basically think that we should put all our energy into good public transport. I mean, I live in Riga a lot of the time. And in Riga, we have trams and we have buses and we have mini buses and we have all sorts of methods of getting around the place that we don't need cars, you know. So if you've got a city, you don't need cars in a city. So I'm okay with that. And as far as particles are concerned, a lot of these particles are dangerous. And there's no question that the epidemiology shows that people exposed to particles have a higher level of all sorts of diseases, particularly strokes and heart attacks and so forth. So particles are not good. And diesel vehicles produce particles, so that's not good. So the way I would do it is reduce the particles just by having fewer vehicles and having very cheap public transport. I mean, I can get right across Riga for €1. It's absurd.
What about this move towards zero carbon? I mean, the idea is really it is a scientific argument, very much a scientific argument, and the latest that they're saying in the green movement these days, what some people are who are leaders of the green movement, is that we really need to stop rearing livestock, and this has been an argument for a long, long time, but they seem to be using the zero carbon argument that actually you can get more protein out of growing arable crops than you can out of rearing livestock. So finally, what do you make of that?
Well, I would have to look at the numbers. I would think it probably is true on a minor level, on some sort of level. I would think it probably is true because of all the methane and so on. I mean, the fact is that it is much more efficient for people to be vegetarians than to eat meat. I mean, it's, in terms of just straight efficiency, that's like money put in against food got out. People can live quite well on a basic vegetarian diet with a little bit of meat or a little bit of fish. They can do that. I think I'm behind any arguments relating to all of this economic stuff that reduce our impact on nature. I mean, we basically treat nature like a sort of commodity, like something we can just dip into and steal. And that's not good, because ultimately nature will take its revenge on us. And I think what I see at the moment is nature is taking its revenge on us. And the future looks pretty horrifying. But of course, nobody will do anything about it, because the machine is too big. I don't think that there are evil people doing these things particularly, although there are a lot of evil people involved in it. I think that the problem we have is that we have built this monstrous machine out of a sort of capitalist, if you like to call it that, or neo-capitalist mechanical and mathematical necessity, and it can't be killed. That's the problem, and it will just eventually end up like one pike in the pond and no fish.
But there are, I mean, this is, hang on, because there's this whole World Economic Forum, Great Reset, looking at the economics and the climate and saying we're going to fix it.
Well, you know that isn't true. Nobody believes that nonsense. I mean, nobody does fix it, do they? It just gets worse every day. It gets worse. And in fact, what it seems to me is that climate scientists themselves are wrong, because it's accelerating much faster than anybody predicted. So all these computer models that they have, and they get lots of money for these computer models, like the computer models on which they base the radiation and health effects, are just bogus models. I think that you cannot apply science in you see, the trouble with science is it's essentially reductionist, and it tries to do things with numbers that basically can't do with numbers. The reduction of reality into small boxes necessary for the computer models to operate is impossible. It can't be done. So what they get is they have a bogus model, and they say, and they press the computer button, and it whirs away and comes out with an answer. And nearly always the answer is wrong. Like Lord Salisbury said long ago in the 19th century, he said, never trust the expert. He is bound to be wrong. And it does seem as if every time they make a decision about what they should do on the basis of what they think is going to happen, they're wrong.
Okay, well, how do people follow your work online, and maybe you could even recommend one of your books which looks at these questions of radioactive discharge and their effects on health, Chris?
Well, I have two books. There's one called Wolves of Water, which was 2006, and another called Wings of Death. And the best way that they can get them is they need to write to me, because I have all sorts of problems with Amazon and so forth. You know, it's too complicated. So if somebody writes to me, they can pay me. They're not expensive, 10 quid or something like that. They can pay me the on PayPal, chris@greenaudit.org or Green Audit on PayPal, and I'll get somebody to post a book to them. The book is called Wolves of Water, 2006, and the other one is called Wings of Death, 1995. And they both more or less say the same thing. The Wings of Death, which I wrote right at the beginning of all of this, sets out the problem. And more or less, I haven't changed my position on what it says. And the other one is about cover-ups. So the other one shows that the British government have been systematically covering all of this stuff up in the most dishonest and horrifying sort of John le Carré way, more or less since it began. Because the British government ultimately is a government of warmongers, and they need to have nuclear in order to have a seat at the table of nuclear weapons dominating hegemony, and that's what they are, and they're even more so like that now. So that's what the second book is about. And apart from that, I haven't really had the time to say very much about all of these things. And recently I've been asked by Sputnik to write stuff, and so I've written stuff on Sputnik, and I sometimes put out articles here and there. So the best way to see myself is just to Google my name, and you'll find it all. There's a ton of stuff. Google Dr. Christopher Busby. If you Google Chris Busby, you'll get some Irish referee.
Okay, Chris. Okay, final question is got to be on Hinkley C. Some people are actually saying it's a white elephant and may even never get switched on. I mean, it does seem to have been being built for ever. Well, a decade at least they've been constructing it down there. They've had to switch off Hinkley B. It's come to the end of its life. The idea was that by now Hinkley C would have been up and running. It seems to be way behind schedule, way over budget. But will it ever happen?
No. They don't have the money for it all. I mean, the problem is that the financials, the economic system in the West is dying. And people, in order to build Hinkley C, people increasingly have to be paid more money, and things have to be bought that cost more money, and then they find that they don't work because the people who make these things are idiots, and so on. I mean, big nuclear is such a mess that I don't really think it will ever. But I may be wrong, but I mean, that's my position on it. I don't think that Hinkley C will ever come online.
But they've ploughed so much money into it, billions.
Well, okay, so, you know, they think of how much money they've given to the Ukrainians, you know, for this war. I mean, these operations are carried out, in my opinion, to encourage people to invest in various technologies, and so then they can go bust and run off with the money. I mean, this is a modern method of survival, is that you have a big plan to build some enormous thing like a railway that goes across England, and like that famous railway that they were going to build. Everybody puts money into it, and on the basis of that, they can borrow money from the banks. Okay, so everybody borrows money from the banks, and then quietly, the money sort of slips away to everybody's uncle and auntie and so forth, and then they go bankrupt, and that's it. I'm afraid I find that modern politics is just gangsterism. Okay, I don't have a lot of faith in any of it. I mean, whoever you vote for, the government gets in, and the government always does something ridiculous and wrong, and certainly that's true in Britain. Okay. Horrifying.
Okay, Chris Busby, enjoying your public transport over in Latvia. Thanks very much for joining us.
That's okay. Cheers.